I want to start my sermon off today with a question. Are you ready? Here's the question. Among all generations represented in this congregation, or any other congregation for that matter, whose job is it to support the work of the church? Think about it for a moment. In a typical life, when is the best time to support the work of the church? Kids under 12 don't have any money to speak of. If they're like I was at 12 or under 12, they have a meager allowance they're given by their parents. In the teen years, those part-time jobs don't bring in very much, and usually they have their mind set on buying something, like a little motorbike or a bicycle. In the 20s, it's college or military or job for a great many people, followed by years of educational loans and getting started in that first real job for those so blessed to find one. With the average age of the newly married going up and up, the 30s are often the time for settling down with that special person and starting a family. Oh boy, mortgage payments, diapers, pediatrician bills, not to mention either daycare or living on one salary for a time so the kids are being cared for. What about the 40s then? Let's ratchet up another 10 years. Well, the kids are going to college soon, and you know what that means. Surely then, the decade of the 50s must be the time, secure in one's profession, the empty nest, and, you know, all of that. Well, in this day and age, you know the nest doesn't stay empty for long, as the little birds have a fine way of finding their way back. And besides, for many, it's educational loans, round two, not for ourselves, but the dreaded parental loans. Well then, it must be the 60s, right, that offer the most promise. Topping the pay scale, retirement on the horizon. They call retirement the golden years. And that sounds pretty good for the church, doesn't it? By that line of reasoning, a church full of 60-somethings ought to be golden in more ways than one. Were it not for the fact that the 60s are also the time when many people sit down with a financial planner and realize that with today's longer lifespans, they haven't put away enough as they need for retirement. Dare we even mention the 70s? You know, they're now talking about two phases of retirement, a more active phase of retirement, then a second phase of spending down, of downsizing, thinking about a time when special medical care may be needed soon. The 80s and 90s, more people today are living that long, but there's also the little matter of medical expenses to be concerned about. Medicare is a big help, but there's either that big deductible or the Medicare supplement insurance we have the pleasure of paying for. You get the point, though. There's no one out there in the multitude who's particularly well situated to make a generous gift to undergird the church's work today. Funny, but that's pretty much the same thing Jesus' disciples are thinking as he sends them out to forage for food to feed the hungry crowd. They come back with a pittance, 5 round barley loaves and 2 fish, either smoked or salted to keep them. Picnic lunch, maybe for a peasant family. You know what happens next. We just heard it. Jesus takes the bread and the fish, offers thanks to God, then begins breaking off one piece, then another, than another. The disciples start handing the broken pieces out. The food just keeps on coming, like the meal jar in the oil jug of the widow of Zarephath. It never runs out. Some say this is a supernatural event with the Son of God, bending the laws of abundance and scarcity that govern the universe that we all have to live with. Others would say Jesus' example of sharing inspires the crowd to dig down deep into their own knapsacks and get serious about sharing for a change. May I suggest that the 5,000 number is probably not accurate because it didn't include women and children, the gospel says. In fact, in those days, you didn't leave home without your wife and your children. It wasn't safe. So it may have been three times 5,000. Could have been the feeding of the 15,000. Multiply, increase, food, or just maybe, hearts were changed that day. What is harder to do? To increase food in baskets or to change someone's heart and mind? Maybe that's what happened that day, and that's why it was a miracle. Either way, it's a miracle. A bright flower sprouts in the midst of a barren desert. Abundance suddenly shows its comely face in the very midst of scarcity. Sounds like an experience we could all use today, doesn't it? Three things happened on that day after Jesus receives that humble, heartfelt gift of loaves and fishes. These three things can serve as spiritual stepping stones, if you will, for us. Jesus breaks the bread, the disciples share, and then everyone eats. First, there is the breaking. There's a sort of breaking that must take place on our part, too, if we're ever going to become true followers of Jesus. We have to make a clean break with conventional wisdom, what our culture teaches us day after day. That wisdom says the goal of life is to be happy, and the way to become happy is to become wealthy. Money, in this way of thinking, is the distilled essence of happiness, we are told, when in fact, Jesus says we should seek joy, a virtue, and not happiness, an emotion that can quickly change due to circumstances. I remember one breakfast I was having with my wife, and I made the first part of the meal, and she helped with the other parts, and one of the things that she prepared was toast. The problem was that it was a little bit darker than you would want to receive your toast to eat it. Did that make me happy? I don't think so. I wasn't angry or mad or upset, so we did it again. But you see, an emotion can change rather suddenly when a virtue is a constant in our life. Money can't buy happiness, says the old proverb, and it's true. Yet aren't we always on the lookout for a shortcut in this life? Wouldn't we just love to lay hold of that patent medicine bottled of distilled joyfulness and take a swig or two? We've got to make a clean break with all of that. Very often there's a necessity for us to become broken ourselves before we learn what it means to take the loaf in our hands and tear it into smaller pieces and offer it to our neighbors. We were talking in the class this morning about loving our neighbor as ourself. And when you do that, you fulfill the summary of the law, because you love God in the process of loving your neighbor. Often it's those who have known something of hardship and suffering who are the most motivated to share what they have. Study after study has shown that the highest percentage of giving, mind you, not the highest dollar amount, comes from the poor. You heard it right. It's a conundrum, but it's true. There's no other way to live a thoroughly Christian life in this materialistic culture. You've got to be broken, truly broken, just as it is with any bread loaf. You've got to break through that hard crust before you know what it means to taste the soft, warm interior and to share it. And next comes the sharing. The disciples could simply take the bread and fish Jesus hands them and gobble it up. Surely they were hungry as well, but they don't. They don't do that. They begin distributing the broken pieces to the groups of people sitting on the grass in front of them in small groups. Each person in that group, in turn, takes some of the bread and fish and passes it back to someone behind them. There's no indication of a mob scene, no mad scramble to grab some of the scarce relief supplies as we see today in other places in the world. One of the major lessons included in any preschool curriculum is sharing. That's right, sharing. Kids don't come by sharing naturally, and maybe that's an argument for original sin. As every parent of a preschooler knows, sharing must be taught. It is not innate. It's a paradox that the higher one climbs in the educational system, in our way of thinking and practice, the less emphasis there is on sharing. Those early childhood lessons of letting another kid pick a crayon from our box are replaced with a passion for individual achievement. At the highest levels, the postgraduate professional schools like medicine or law or even seminaries, there are tales of cutthroat competition, of students sabotaging one another's research. It's the polar opposite of what we learned in kindergarten, to share. Is that truly an example of higher education? The final thing Jesus has the people do that day is to eat together, not separate, together. It's one vast picnic, everyone partaking together. This is in marked contrast to the rules of dinner etiquette at a typical Greek or Roman banquet of the day. Guests at those events are ranked according to their order of importance, with the most important person reclining at the host's right hand. You can glimpse just a little of this custom in that scene in the Bible when James and John, the sons of thunder, run up to Jesus and ask him if they can have the seats of honor at the heavenly banquet, one at his right and one at his left. Jesus will have none of that, he tells them. The greatest in the heavenly realm, he explains, is the one who serves others. So, whose job is it to support the work of the church? That responsibility belongs to no one and to everyone. Everyone who's got a lunch, that is, no matter how humble the fare may be. When is the right time in life to truly step up and become a Christian steward? Ask the question that way and you'll never get an answer. Just a lot of hemming and hawing. The only answer possible is that stewardship is a priority for every person of every age. All four Gospels, all four of them, tell the story of the abundant loaves and fish, but only one of the Gospel writers provides a further detail that helps us answer that question. That explanation comes from the Gospel of John. Only John tells us who it is who actually offers up his lunch that day. It's a boy, not a man, not a woman, a boy. He's just a kid, that benevolent donor who, by his selfless giving, makes that miracle possible that day. So are you a kid? Have you ever been a kid? And if so, you've got what it takes. You've got everything Jesus needs to work a miracle, a generous heart. So open it up and trust the Lord to do the rest. He just might feed 15,000 people in front of you. In the name of the living God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit.